Joining me now from Santa Fe, from an undisclosed secret location in Santa Fe, Carolyn Frazier, are you there?
I am.
Good to hear you. I'm sorry to delay our interview, but I'm trying to keep up. What a Week tries to keep up with the insanity of the world, and that's the short form. We usually do an hour on this stuff. Let me introduce you, though, to our audience. Well, your credits are pretty formidable. You're author of three nonfiction books, God's Perfect Child, Rewilding the World, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Prairie Fires, The American Dreams of Laura Ingalls Wilder. You won a Pulitzer Prize in 2018. You've written for The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, The Atlantic Monthly, Outside Magazine, and The London Review of Books. And let me just say, Carolyn, you're punching way below your weight joining us here on What a Week. So we're really glad to hear you. But you did 2 hours with Joe Rogan a couple weeks ago, which we may talk about later. So we'll see what's going on. Well, let's just jump right into it. The book tore my head off. I read Joyce Carol Oates' review in the New York Review of Books and immediately said, as Joyce Carol Oates is a great way to introduce a book, was like, boy, this is extremely provocative. And she really just summarized the book. But what it does is there's three books in one, in my opinion. There's a very forensic and somewhat gruesome account of the litany of very scary and very bad men serial killers that were haunting the Pacific Northwest in the early 70s. There's an account, a parallel account of the toxic waste, corruption, crimes against nature, and ultimately man let's just say, the Guggenheims. We'll talk about them in a second. And then embedded in the book is your memoir of growing up, and they all fuse together. And then the subtext is the Mercer Island Tram, the Mercer Island Bridge Highway. So I guess my first question is, after you won your Pulitzer for a book about Little House on the Prairie and Michael Landon, you could have written any book in the world. That's a pretty good e-ticket to do and get published whatever you want. You did this. Why?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have asked me that. So I think that some of it had to do with the fact that I had actually started writing this book before I wrote Prairie Fires. And I didn't really know what I was writing. I began, to put down some of these memories that I had of the 1970s and growing up in the Pacific Northwest. And writing those things down really made me realize what a strange time it was in many ways. And I think very unstable time. We're certainly in an unstable time again, but in a different way, I think. And so I really wanted to go back to that material once I had finished the Laura Ingalls Wilder biography and see what I could make of it. And as I began pulling this material together, I started to see connections between my story growing up in the 70s and a lot of what was happening in terms of crime and, as you mentioned, the environmental crimes that were being committed at the time.
Well, your neighbors, literal neighbors, that nice boy down the block. I mean, you had neighbors who turned out to be very bad guys, correct?
Yeah, there was, in fact, a serial killer who grew up on Mercer Island, which seems incredible when you say it now, because Mercer Island is known for being a fairly well-to-do suburb. Lots of millionaires live there now. It wasn't quite that, 1%, 1%-ish in the 70s, but it certainly was always a place that seemed on the outside to be safe, to be not someplace that you would associate with this kind of mayhem. But in fact, during the 70s, there was a lot of crime on the island. And that, when I discovered that doing the research for the book, that really came to be interesting to me, because the island, along with a lot of the rest of Seattle and Puget Sound, was within the plume of this sort of toxic plume of the Asarco smokestack, Asarco being the American smelting and refining company.
And this, folks, is a thing. What? How tall was it? In the over 500 feet tall, or do they have the 1,000-footer up by then?
No, I think that they topped out at over 500 feet, but it was for a while the tallest smokestack on the West Coast.
And it's belching. It's belching toxic lead waste basically across the entire area. And the premise, I mean, again, we're trying to reduce a major work of nonfiction down to glib talking points here, so forgive me, Carolyn, but the premise, or one of the main premises of the book, is young Ted Bundy, young Gary Ridgway, young Richard Ramirez, all of these soon-to-be monsters are ingesting these toxic chemicals, and it's literally altering their brains. It's warping their brains, not just that they're torturing small animals and suffering child abuse in the usual scenario. The toxic waste factor is amplifying and intensifying whatever latent things are going on them. And is that a fair assessment of what?
Yeah. I mean, you know, was looking particularly at Tacoma, the city that is, as most people are probably familiar with, SeaTac Airport, if you've ever flown in there. Tacoma is about 30 miles south of and one of the things about me as I was looking at this stuff, both Ted Bundy and Gary Ridgway, who was of course, the Green River Killer, grew up in or around Tacoma. And for a while, Charles Manson was also incarcerated on an island, McNeil, one of the federal prisons. That is also quite close to Tacoma. And so when I was looking at that period, I just wondered, boy, was there anything that could explain why these three really famous, notable murderers, how they could all have been in the same place at the same time? And one of the things that popped up as I started to do this research was the Asarco smokestack, because of course lead pollution has now been linked very strongly through a number of long-term research studies to violence and to aggression. And so kids who were exposed to large amounts of lead pollution are more than likely to become, you know, juvenile delinquents, perhaps, to commit crimes as they grow older, and that pattern is most notable in men.
Well, that's something I noticed is there aren't women serial killers. I mean, a few, but not with the same degree of kind of cliched repetitiveness and the same kind of, it's hard to lump all of these monsters together in their methodology and madness, but there are certain trends, and you don't see that with women. I mean, is that something that there's any statistical studies on? Because I would think that, not pointing a finger at you, but aren't you breathing in that same toxic air?
Sure.
And you won a Pulitzer, and you didn't, unless I'm mistaken, there's no mysterious disappearances near Taos that you can be accounted for.
I mean, there are studies that show that the more lead that you have, the more likely you are to commit acts of aggression or violence. And in terms of the male component of that, what you see is that there are, not only are there, you know, far more serial killers who are men, than women, but there are, you know, the vast majority of murders are committed by men as opposed to women. With women, what they have studied and what they've noticed is a certain impulsivity. And they have tied in some studies the rise in teen pregnancies, which went up quite sharply in the 70s and 80s, to lead exposure for women. So that's an interesting comparison.
Well, it's been said that behind every great fortune is a great crime. And one thing that I picked out of your book was, we all know the Sacklers, whose name is still being chiseled off of every artistic institution that they funded. But we don't see anything happening to the Guggenheim in New York, or Peggy Guggenheim's legacy as an art collector. And it's the Guggenheims who basically, they're the ones who built the smelter, correct? I mean, this wave of, and it's not just creating serial killers, this is huge health consequences to the people who are growing up in the plume of this smokestack.
Yeah, it was the Guggenheim family who became very much associated and invested in smelting, which, you know, we don't talk about smelting a lot anymore. We don't see it in our communities because for the most part, those smelters have closed. Most of them closed in the 1980s because they couldn't legally do what they were doing under EPA regulations and so forth, under the Clean Air Act.
Well, let me guess that as soon as there was causal links between grave health concerns and these smelters, the responsible corporations immediately changed their ways. There was no denial. There was no corporate obfuscation. And they immediately shut things down and with huge apologies to the people. Am I correct in this assessment, Carol?
Well, the change was in where they were doing business. They shut down smelters in the United States and they moved them somewhere else.
And that somewhere else is one of them is Juarez, which was also absolutely was and is a hotbed of crime against women. And you mentioned that too. When these start adding up here, I don't want to go full Joe Rogan on you, but it seems, at least from corporate malfeasance, there seems to be some very interesting links here.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you know, the whole story of smelting is tragic from the beginning because all these things pop up in the late 1800s in this country. They operate for about 100 years and commit horrific acts of pollution, which, you know, have been cleaned up to some extent, but will never be fully cleaned up. And one of those places where the cleanup is probably not going to happen and hasn't happened is in the city of Juarez, which is right across the border from where ASARCO had another enormous smokestack in El Paso. And so the El Paso smokestack is shut down, you know, in the late 90s or 2000. But they've, you know, the ASARCO has never gone into Mexico and cleaned up the soil there. And so decades and decades of pollution has gone unaddressed.
Well, the thing that obviously, that you know, the topic A, the book is called Murderland, and you know, you name check Edmund Kemper, and Santa Cruz was certainly his field of operation in precisely the same period, 72, 73, 74. And we're still, there's this kind of, anyone around, I would just refer to the elderly white hippies who I'm proud to say, including myself, compose a lot of the people listening to the show right now. If we were in Santa Cruz in the early 70s, you remember that, and it haunted the community. And as details of the crimes came out, and there's a book, a local author named Emerson Murray wrote a book called Murder Capital of the World, which is what Santa Cruz, we were beating the Pacific Northwest there. We were number one, Carolyn Frazier, over Tacoma for a while. But all joking aside, you know, his book really is a collage of articles about this and just how the community was reacting. And then there's this mass forgetting. People forget, try not to remember just how haunted it was. But you went spelunking into this dark cave. And in my career, I've done a lot of true crime projects. I abandoned ship quite a few years back. 2017 was my last foray into that. But a writer who I interviewed for my film Gray State said, talking about this particular crime it focused on, was it kind of gets on you and you can't rub it off. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering just the psychic toll. It's a far jump from Little House in the Prairie, unless you tie in, I have to make a digression. That book, I had a Wisconsin death trip in my head, you know, that photo book, which sort mm-hmm. of has yeah. that same gothic feel. And you put it this way, if you're fans of Michael Landon, this book isn't quite what you're going to read, but it's a must read and it deserves the award it got. But getting back to topic A, you know, how did you cope with it? Because this book gets into relentless detail after relentless detail after relentless forensic detail of these crimes. And it's overwhelming, and it's artistically done, but you still had to go there and research all this stuff.
Yeah, I think that, you know, yes, it was very dark material, and certainly that's true. I have to say, though, that in a way, because I was aware of so much of this, both from having grown up during the period and also having read a lot of, you know, true crime books about this stuff, I think that you know, it's not like reporting about something that's just happening immediately. Like, you know, if you're a war reporter and you're in a war zone and you're reporting it directly, I think that is really quite traumatic in a completely different way. So I don't want to exaggerate the trauma that comes from writing about this stuff. But I think one thing that was, if not shocking, really notable to me was just the degree of violence against women that was accepted during that period. You know, I mean, it was a very, very different time. There were different laws affecting rape victims, for example. And so it is kind of shocking to put yourself back in that mindset. Not that things have improved radically. I mean, look at who's in the White House. You know, an adjudicated rapist is in the White House.
Now, and what a week. We will not have you say a bad word about President Donald Trump. I you know, and you've done the Joe Rogan. You've gone over to the other side here. So,
but you take my point.
I mean, I do.
Things have changed, but they haven't changed enough. And that, I think, is more distressing almost than anything else.
Well, you're listening to What a Week. This is Eric Nelson with Carolyn Frazier, and I'm going to keep saying it, a Pulitzer Prize winning author of the book on Laura Ingalls. And then what does she do? She's got this audience of Michael Landon fans, and she pivots and writes an incredibly dark, deep dish dive into the world of serial killers in the Pacific Northwest. And that's where we're diving deep. One of the things we enjoy doing on the show is playing contextual music. And I asked you if you had any songs that you might want to play. And you immediately pointed me to your Spotify playlist of 30 songs. And this one gets name checked. And it's a song you mentioned that you listened to at the time. And it was on the radio during your formative years. And it's Elvis Presley. You know, you can't go wrong with a king. Wouldn't you not agree, Carolyn Frazier?
Yes.
So we're going to take a quick musical break while everyone picks their jaws up the floor. And when we come back, Carolyn, what I want to talk about is the true crime genre in general, you know, the appeal of this. To me, true crime and true crime documentaries are this invasive species that have eaten up all of the world of documentaries. And maybe this is sour grapes mm-hmm. because, you know, the kinds of films I like to do are tougher and tougher to get away because that's all people want to watch now. But I want to talk to you about that and your thoughts on that entire genre. But meanwhile, this is Elvis Presley. And so, young Carolyn Frazier, you're listening to this. Is this true? Set this song up.
You know, I don't remember this song, but I'm sure that people were who were a little older than I was in 1961 do remember it. And this was a song that was a hit at that time, at a moment when it is entirely likely that Ted Bundy committed his first murder.
Can't you see I love you? Please don't break my heart in two. That's not hard to do, 'cause I don't have a wooden heart. And if you say goodbye, then I know that I would cry. Maybe I would die, 'cause I don't have a wooden heart. There's no strings upon this love of mine. It was always you from the start. Treat me nice, treat me good, treat me like you really should. 'Cause I'm not made of wood, and I don't have a wooden heart. Muss ich denn zum Städtelehinhaus, Städtelehinhaus, und du mein Schatz bleibst hier. Muss ich denn zum Städtelehinhaus, Städtelehinhaus, und du mein Schatz bleibst hier. There's no strings upon this love of mine. It was always you from the start. Sei mir gut, wie du wirklich sollst, wie du wirklich sollst, 'cause I don't have a wooden heart.
Well, I'm not sure you've ruined Elvis Presley for me permanently, but I certainly never going to hear Wooden Heart again when I think of 8-year-old Ted or 14-year-old Ted Bundy listening to it before he abducts and kills an 8-year-old neighbor, which isn't a verified crime of his, but you're pretty sure it's a legitimate one. All right. Well, Ted Bundy, for instance, how many documentaries are on Netflix right now? You know, the confession tapes, the this, the that's, you know, yeah. He's sort of like the big bad. And Ann Rule's book, who worked next to Ted Bundy and then built her entire career based on that and kind of invented in some ways or perfected the genre of true crime. Though you did an article, I think, was in The Atlantic about the True Detective magazines, the gruesome True Detective magazines of the 50s, which, wait for it, young Ted Bundy is reading and cataloging, and some of these guys are all thinking, to them it's a how-to guide, you know, as their brains are being altered by toxic waste. What is it, though? Because the thing that I knew based on the fact that I've done work for Investigation Discovery and was the head writer of Unsolved Mysteries back in the late 80s is that it's women are the audience for these things. You know, men aren't really, when you're on Rogan, he really focused on the environmental stuff. He really wasn't getting his geek on with serial killer stuff. He really was focused on that. But what is it? Why are women watching this stuff and inhaling this material over and over and over? I mean, any educated guess?
Well, yeah, there are polls that have been taken on this topic. So I think we actually know that the reason why has a lot to do with women's fears of violence. And I think you just cannot discount that. And I think that's why the shift happened. You know, I mean, the original true crime genre back in the 1930s and 40s when it was huge. I mean, millions of magazines were sold in the true crime genre, and they were sold to men. But a lot, around the time of Ann Rule and Ted Bundy, there's this massive shift in the audience for true crime, which does shift to women, because I think women began to consume this material that seemed to be about their worst fears. And I think most women, rightly or wrongly, and the you know, the statistics suggest that, well, they don't suggest, they tell us that the most people who are killed, the majority of people who suffer homicide or murder are men, and those men are killed by other men. So fewer women are killed, the victims of homicide, but that doesn't mean that women don't fear being attacked. They fear violence in some form. I would say because many of them have some experience of violence, maybe in the home, maybe in terms of, you know, just the kind of fears that you have walking home at night in a strange place.
But why consume entertainment, though? Is it just the same reason why someone's going to watch Saw or someone's going to watch a horror film, that it's... I always wondered if part of it too is I may be leading a life of quiet desperation watching this stuff, but at least I have it better off than this person or that person. You know, there's almost there's that kind of as bad as my life is, I haven't run into Ted Bundy and his white van. I mean, it's complicated, you know, and that's why there is really no. And do go on. I mean, I've been grappling with this for a long time.
I think that there's, you know, maybe an element of that. But I, you know, what women say when they talk about true crime is that they want to learn about what happens in these attacks so they can avoid it. And that seems to me like a fantasy, because I don't think that reading about Ted Bundy is necessarily going to make you safer moving through the world. But I do think that women particularly have, or are more likely to have had, some experience of violence because of domestic violence. Domestic violence is something that, you know, millions of people, men and women, have experienced growing up or in the home, or they've heard about it, they know somebody that it's happened to, and there is a fear, I think, for women that is not shared by men necessarily. So I think there is this big gulf, and so it does make some women feel better to indulge in this kind of thing to try and understand their lived experience.
Well, one other thing, though, that's just, again, we report, you, dear listener, decide, is many these films that are coming out almost exclusively revolve around missing white women or murdered white women. You know, that's the center. And when you look at indiscriminate killers like Gary Ridgway, he went after everybody. I mean, if a woman was breathing, he targeted, whereas Bundy was very selective in their victims. But I guess that the perpetrators of this genre of true crime films seem to have an unconscious or conscious racial bias. Have you noticed that? Is that a thing? And if so, why?
Yeah, I think it's undeniably a thing, especially on television. I think that the genre of true crime, as it is expressed through documentaries or you know, recreations on TV, is much more likely to focus on white victims, and that's a shame. You know, it's an expression of the racism and the culture, for sure. I do think that there are indications that true crime, especially books and articles, are beginning to show a shift to include more. There are now books about murders of Native American women in British Columbia, or gay victims in New York City. So I think that the genre is, you know, being dragged kicking and screaming.
But the pathology, on some level, of the serial killer, though, doesn't seem to be, they're going after women. They're not saying necessarily we're going after Native Americans. It's targets of opportunity, it seems. You know, again, looking at the various cases you look at, except for, say, Rader, Donald Rader, the BTK killer, was just all about obsessive planning, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of this just seems very random. You know, Ted Bundy's just driving, looking for a target of opportunity, and bam, up he abducts someone. The whole, you know, the spectrum of it is well, deliberately haunting. What surprised you? I mean, you approach this not your book is called Murderland, I must say, and Ted Bundy is on the cover, but that's probably more your publisher's thing. But it's absolutely relentlessly non-titillating and very analytical. What got you? I mean, other than the major premise of the book, the link, the causal link between toxic waste and toxic lead poisoning in these killers' minds, did anything else like leap out at you that you said, huh, no one's noticed this before? I've seen this. This is something interesting.
Well, I think one of the things that became very apparent to me as I was writing these descriptions of the serial killers and what they did, and the corporations like ASARCO and what they did, was that there is just such a extraordinary similarity between their behavior. Because one of the things that is so apparent in the behavior of serial killers, for example, is their compulsive lying. They lie about everything. Dennis Rader, who you were just mentioning, the BTK killer, lied to his family for decades.
There's an incredible, I don't know if you've read it, but one of the all-time best Stephen King novellas is called The Good Wife, and it's in essence written from the perspective of Mrs. Rader, who discovers discovers his hideaway of victims' driver's licenses, and we go from there. And it's an incredible story because that always fascinated me. Is, you know, do you think she knew, Mrs. Rader knew what was going on or suspected it?
No, I absolutely do not believe that she did. And his Dennis Rader's daughter and son didn't know either. I think it's very easy for people to jump to the conclusion that family members, you know, knew. And then there are, I think, some cases where they may have known something was happening and didn't make the connection or whatever. But, you know, in that case, no, I don't think she knew at all. But again, I think there is this extraordinary, you know, mirroring of, you know, the corporate behavior with the serial killer behavior, because the corporations were also lying their heads off about everything. They were being confronted beginning in the 1960s with what they had done, what they were doing. People were trying to get statistics on how much lead, how much arsenic was being put into the atmosphere above Tacoma and El Paso, Texas. And they were lying about all of this. They were trying to bribe people not to talk about it. And, you know, the things that they did were murderous in much the same way that serial killers were murderous.
Now, you're not going to tell me that rampant pathological lying can be evaded with no consequences or even promotion. I find that premise very hard to grasp, but maybe that's just me. Why don't we take another musical break here? And Carolyn, this was not on your list, but this song kind of got under my skin. It, you know, there's part of the pleasure of doing a show on an FM freeform radio station is we can actually play music, which podcasts can't do. Even Joe Rogan can't do it. So there you go. You notice I'm obsessing on Joe Rogan here, but what can I say? But this song sort of makes you feel a certain way, though. It's tough to top Elvis Presley, but let's try this. You're listening to What a Week. I'm with Carolyn Frazier, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Murderland. And we're going to be back, try to pivot this to a slightly more optimistic outcome. Let's see if we can do that when we come back from this little foray into serial killerdom.
Some like your neighbor, somebody, even I like them all. I put my feet up on the coffee table. I stay up late watching cable. I like old movies with Clark Gable, just like my dad. Like my dad did when he was home. Staying up late, staying up late. Just like my dad did when he was thinking, oh, how fast the years fly.
Song kind of comes at you.
Yeah, that's surprising.
Well, you know, it's a you know, it's in the head of a serial killer, not talking about it, but whatever. You know, there's, and I think you, someone I'm sure has mentioned this, though not certainly Joe Rogan, he mentions it again. There's a David Lynchian quality to your book. You know, it really reminded me so much of Twin Peaks, you know, that kind of Pacific Northwest seasonal affective disorder, rain, strange, you know, gothic goings on. And I want to talk a bit, Carolyn Frazier, author of Murderland, about the memoir portion of the book. And I say this, it sounds like a hostile question. It's not, but it's the language of the work. What possessed you to put yourself in the book?
Well, there were a few things. I mean, one of it was just the structure of the book itself, which I felt that so much of the focus that was on the serial killer part was so hard to take in a way that it needed something to lighten the narrative a little bit. I didn't feel that I could just talk about one murder after another without breaking away to kind of give a sense, and this is another reason why I put this stuff in, to give a sense of what life was like at that time. You know, it was a very, very different time economically, politically, in terms of what it was like to grow up as a girl in that area. And so it served that purpose. It served the purpose, I think, of also providing more of that atmosphere that you're talking about, the Twin Peaks atmosphere, if you will, of what things looked like and smelled like and sounded like in terms of the songs. And it provided a way to kind of personalize the material in a way that I hoped people would respond to, and not just have it be this kind of litany of terrifying events.
Well, I responded, it literally knocked me off the couch when I read it. And that's a passage of the book when you say, young you go to a science fair, Star Trek convention. I think you were 16 in 1977. And there you confront a gentleman, a short gentleman by the name of Harlan Ellison. And you name check City and the Edge of Forever, where Kirk and Spock go back in time and Kirk has to allow the love of his life to die, written by Harlan Ellison, which I saw when it was first broadcast. And and 77 was the first time I met Harlan Ellison. And the doorway he opened for you through his nonfiction was that you could get out. You could write your way out. And I that knocked me out. And I have to say, Carolyn, Harlan passed away the year you won your Pulitzer. And I wish he would have been so proud of you and so amazed and so gratified that you inspired him. A little jealous, I bet, because he always felt he didn't get his awards on. But that really knocked me out. I just had to bring that up to you live on the radio. And if Harlan, if you're listening, I don't know where you are now. Certainly all the mean things you said about God, you're not in heaven. But so if you want to say anything about Harlan, please do, Carolyn.
Oh, well, thank you for saying that. I mean, that's sort of wonderful. I just kind of fell in love with his work and was really seduced by it, you know, in high school, just the incredible way that he wrote about his own life and about becoming a writer. You know, I mean, I loved the science fiction stuff and responded to that as well. But I think what really, really got to me was that, okay, here's this guy who, you know, was growing up as a kid in Ohio and was able to take, you know, hard work and some modicum of talent and just the force of his personality, which was an incredible personality, and just turn that into an amazing career. And I was so inspired by that. And he really made it possible to think about being a writer. You know, I mean, I'd been reading all along and loved a number of writers and responded to them, but I couldn't really see myself following in their footsteps because they were too exalted or something. But Harlan Ellison was somebody who I felt you really could kind of take this as advice for a writing life.
Well, Harlan, I hope you're listening wherever you find, whatever atheistic world you find yourself in now. Well, I said that we talk about like somewhat more positive things, and let's talk crime statistics. We talked earlier about the criminal cesspool of Washington, D.C. and soon Chicago, where the Mango Mussolini, the apparently African-American women with tears in their eyes are begging him to come personally to liberate them from the hellish crime of Chicago. But in reality, the crime rates, when they cleaned up the lead, not that we're drawing any conclusions here, they clean up the lead, they shut the smelter down, and all of a sudden that generation starts dying off, and that epidemic of serial killings also die off. Can you, put some credibility into that statement?
Yeah, I mean, basically, if you are believing anything that is coming out of the Trump administration about crime,
we're not.
I've got a bridge I can sell you because it's all hooey. And, the fact of the matter is that the worst crime rates that we have had in this country came about during the 1970s and 80s and early 90s. And they reached heights at that time of more than 10 per 100,000 in terms of homicide per year. And that had never been seen before as long as, for example, the FBI had been keeping these statistics, and it hasn't been seen since. So everything that they're saying now, crime is very, it's lies and it's misleading, and it doesn't take into account the fact that there may actually have been some real reasons why the crime rate went up in the 70s and 80s. And then after, for example, lead was removed from gasoline, it starts going down quite precipitously. And there's probably more than one reason for that. It's probably not just about lead, but there is a good argument to be made that the removal of lead from the environment did have something to do with that.
Well, why don't we wrap it on that? You know, it's tough to do a one-hour deep dive conversation discussing a book called Murderland, Crime and Bloodlust in the Time of Serial Killers and end on an upbeat ending. But that's about as upbeat as I think we can get. Wouldn't you not agree, Carolyn Fraser?
Yeah, I think you put your finger all right on it.
I've hit the nail with my head on that. Well, thank you so much for joining. As I said, you cheated in the book because you did a shout out to Harlan Ellison. And I have to admit, but the book absolutely captivated me. And Joe Rogan, have you noticed I'm obsessing? On YouTube, you can see the 2 hours to watch Carolyn uncomfortably squirming as he holds forth on anti-vax, et cetera, et cetera. But it does have 675,000 YouTube hits, let alone the 20 million people who listen to the show. So I hope it's moving some books. I'm not completely convinced that What a Week and our audience of elderly 90-year-old stupid hippies, and that's Stephen Miller, not me, dear audience, and he's not, and I happily include myself in that demographic, are going to buy that many books, but by God, you should. It's a great, terrific book. And thank you so much for joining. And I'll leave you, one thing we do on What a Week is we play new music, songs that have just been released, records, CDs that have just come out. And I swear to God, this is true. This CD just came out last week. So I'll leave you with the appropriate song here. Thank you.
This is KSQD, Santa Cruz, 90.7 FM. KSQT, Prunedale, 89.7 and 89.5 FM. And KSQD.org.